Chapter 24. The Abstract Generation. The Biggest Losers. This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time wore soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin's 1971 poem paints a bit of a dreary picture of parenting, but sadly, there is some truth in it. The period of destructive abundance in which we are currently living is due in large part to the good intentions of our parents and their parents before them. The boomer generation, the very generation who, throughout the 1980s and 1990s, worked to reinvent business to suit the times, dismantled many of the protections we had in the name of individual advancement and corporate profitability. At the same time, they were embracing new ideas about how to raise their children, which included additional focus on individualism and personal achievement. In perhaps the greatest irony of this period, however, the parenting strategies that boomers popularized actually left many of their children less prepared to work in the very corporate environments that they themselves built, ones in which circles of safety are the exception rather than the rule. The greatest generation, raised during the Great Depression and wartime rationing, wanted to ensure that their children did not suffer or miss out on their youth as they did. This is good. This is what all parents want, for their children to avoid their hardships and prosper. And so that's how the boomers were raised, to believe that they shouldn't have to go without, which, as a philosophy, is perfectly fine and reasonable. But given the size of the generation and the abundance of resources that surrounded them, the philosophy got a little distorted. When you consider the rising wealth and affluence of their childhood, combined for good reasons with a cynicism towards government in the 1970s, followed by the boom years of the 1980s and the 1990s, it's easy to see how the boomers earned their reputation as the me generation, me before we. Putting the protection of ideas and wealth before the sharing of them is now standard. A New Jersey-based accountant told me that he sees a clear difference between his older clients and his younger ones. My older clients want to work within the confines of the tax code to do what is fair, he explained. They are willing to simply pay the tax they owe. The next generation spends lots of time looking to exploit every loophole and nuance in the tax code to reduce their responsibility to as little as possible, he says. When the baby boomers started having children of their own, they raised their children to be cynical about those in charge. Don't let people get things from you if they aren't willing to compensate you for it, went the thinking. Don't let anything stand in the way of what you want. Again, all reasonable philosophies, if the circumstances today were the same as when they were younger. But they aren't. And so a few good ideas got a little twisted for the boomers' kids. It was impossible for anyone to predict how parenting strategies developed in the 80s and 90s would impact children in the age of the internet. Both Generation X and Y grew up to believe that they could get whatever they want. Gen X, growing up before the internet, interpreted that lesson as putting your head down and getting to work. An overlooked and forgotten generation, Gen Xers didn't really rebel against anything or stand for much in their youth. Sure, there was the Cold War, but it was the nicer, gentler version of the Cold War than existed in the 1960s and 1970s. Gen Xers didn't grow up practicing drills at school in case of nuclear attack. Growing up in the 1980s was a good life. The 1990s and the new millennium saw even more boom years. Dot-com, e-commerce, email, e-dating, free overnight shipping, no waiting, get it now. All of which had an impact on the generation that came of age at this time. Born in the early 1980s through the early 2000s, members of Gen Y are also referred to as millennials because they were the first generation to come of age in the 21st century. They are the first generation to grow up with the internet, smartphones, and social media. Millennials are often accused of being superficial, lazy, and disrespectful. These kinds of complaints aren't new, however. Similar charges seem to be leveled at each succeeding generation. "Kids these days" is a phrase that never goes out of style. It is true that by the very nature of youth, young people across generations do share some tendencies. They often reject the advice of those with gray hair, are generally quick to embrace new ideas and technologies, and want to carve out their own distinct identities in the world. It's not surprising that their elders find them difficult to understand or fear that they are threats to the traditional way of doing things. The response by boomers and even some older Gen Xers to millennials is no different. For those who think that generalizations cannot be made about one generation or another, the fact is, the experiences we have during our formative years shape us into who we are, not just as individuals, but as a collective, too. Of course, there are exceptions to the rule, and generational divides are not as hard set as some often claim. However, when cataclysmic events like the Vietnam War or 9/11 occur, or when life-changing technologies like the light bulb or the internet are introduced, there is an undeniable societal impact on the people living at the time. And that impact will vary depending on, among other factors, the age of those affected. Many of those children of the 1930s and 1940s, for example, who grew up with the poverty of the Great Depression and the rationing of World War II, developed lifelong tendencies towards frugality and conservation. For some, this showed up as needing to squeeze every last bit of toothpaste out of the tube. For others, it was coupon clipping. But the shared pattern seems to have the same source. They all experienced some degree of economic hardship at a formative time in their lives. Like the generations who preceded them, millennials have been impacted by the dominant events and technologies of their youth. As a result, we're starting to hear some new and quite specific complaints about the millennial generation that we cannot as easily write off as kids just being kids. These go beyond the same recycled grievances every generation has about the next. These are unique characterizations that are significantly attached to the behavior and performance of millennials in the workplace. Many employers complain that their millennial employees, for example, are poor communicators, lack the instinct to be proactive, cannot handle critical feedback, are impatient, are unable to commit, and the big one, have a sense of entitlement. Of the many, many stories I've heard about millennial employees, one story perfectly captures the entitled attitude that they are accused of having. Courtney, a young entry-level employee, was hired as a part-time personal assistant. She was paid $20 an hour to be on site and on call for the occasional errand, for example, fetching coffee, picking up lunch, and so on. Knowing that she was a performing artist, Courtney's employer encouraged her to research casting calls online when she wasn't needed. She could also read a book, surf social media, or stream a movie if she wanted. The point is, the majority of the time that she was paid to be at work was basically her own, to do with as she pleased. As if that were not enough, she also had flexible work hours. She got to choose the days and times she worked based on her audition and rehearsal schedule. After some time, Courtney asked for a raise. She wanted $30 per hour. When asked to make her case for a 50% pay increase, she made one simple argument. "That's what I think I'm worth." She was not invited back to work again. This story is not unique. There seems to be a disproportionately high number of employers who feel that their entry-level millennial employees are making unreasonable demands. Across companies big and small, employers share tales not just about requests for unjustified pay increases, but also things like premature promotions, customized schedules, and open access to senior executives. But I've also spoken with countless millennials, and things look a little different from their point of view. Many of them admit not all the stereotypes about them are completely off base, at least in comparative terms. In a Pew survey, for example, the majority of younger people credited older generations with having a stronger work ethic, higher moral values, and greater respect for others. The millennials that I talk to also admit to getting bored easily and say that they don't have a desire to stay with one organization for the whole of their careers. Yet most of them say that they want to work hard and are willing to work hard. This is most evident in their entrepreneurial spirit. Millennials are founding their own businesses at much younger ages than older generations. Boomers started their companies at an average age of 35, whereas the average age at which a millennial takes the plunge is 27. When they're accused of lacking work ethic, many millennials will respond that their bosses don't share their conception of time as it relates to productivity. They don't need to work specific hours in the office. Technology allows them to work remotely whenever they feel like it. Unlike older generations, who are missing out on life because they're chained to their desks, millennials have found a way to do both. And why shouldn't they be entitled? Why shouldn't they expect to earn more, have greater responsibility, and advance up the ranks quickly? Almost everyone agrees that they are, generally speaking, more connected and technologically savvy than their boomer bosses. Millennials are poised to be the most educated generation in history. Rare are the meetings or events that I attend, however, that someone doesn't ask a question about millennials. There seem to be a huge number of employers, including many millennial employers, who struggle when it comes to leading their youngest workers. They express frustration about the generation's lack of resourcefulness, poor writing skills, and demands for early promotions. They also express exasperation that if their millennial employees don't get what they want when they want it, many simply quit. But the knife cuts both ways. I hear just as many complaints from millennials about their frustration with their employers. They express dismay that their bosses don't understand them or their lifestyles, give them enough feedback, or take full advantage of their skills or show enough appreciation for their work. They would also like the companies they work for to have a greater sense of purpose and offer them a work environment in which they can find fulfillment and feel like they are making an impact in the world. Any debate over which side is right could go on forever. If I were to describe my observations about millennials in entirely negative terms, for example, a good number of Gen Xers and boomers would nod their heads in agreement, while millennials would lash out at me for making broad generalizations. However, if I were to only shower millennials with praise and frame everything they do as a strength or an advantage, I expect a lot fewer millennials would accuse me of making gross generalizations about them. Though I would expect more Gen Xers and boomers would scowl and think me an apologist. Both sides have valid points based on their own experiences. Regardless of the lens through which we choose to see things, it seems to me that the only responsible thing for us to do is to try to understand what's going on and use any insights as the basis for a course of action. What both sides of the argument must appreciate is the mutual value of trying to understand the factors that make millennials who they are. If for no other reason, then it will help employers better lead their millennial employees, and it will help millennials find that sense of career fulfillment that seems so elusive. There appear to be three dominant factors that impacted and continue to impact millennials most significantly as they grew up: overparenting, ubiquitous technology, and greater opportunities for instant gratification. The effects of all three are both exacerbated by and sometimes in conflict with the corporate environments in which they now work. Eat dirt. It's good for you. Every parent grapples with this critical decision, whether to swoop in to help their kids or to let them struggle, fall, or fail. One communicates love and support. The other teaches self-reliance and grit. Both are important, but a growing body of evidence suggests that the parents of the millennial generation may have erred on the side of over-coddling their kids and accidentally tipped the delicate balance between the two. Every parent wants to protect their child from the dangers of the world, from bad people, sharp objects, hot things, and of course, the powerful but unseen enemy, bacteria. Thank goodness we have antibacterial products like Purell to kill all those nasty germs. Thanks to pocket-sized potions of protection, we can now sanitize our children after they pick up every stick, press every elevator button, or climb the jungle gym that all the other kids have had their hands on too. But should we? A September 2015 issue of the journal Science reported that kids who grew up in less sanitized environments, in which they have early exposure to animals, plants, dirt, and microbes, actually grow up with fewer allergies. In other words, when it comes to protecting our kids, sometimes less is more. Many parents of millennials admit they may have been overprotective of their children in far too many areas of life. Most common among professional and well-off families, so-called helicopter parents did everything within their power to ensure that their kids avoided catching a cold in the playground. They also worked to safeguard them against everything from broken bones to hurt feelings to academic failure. I know of one mother who actually put knee pads on a child who was learning to walk. Stories abound of parents who demanded teachers give their children higher grades, wangled invites to birthday parties, or wrote their teenagers' college application essays. Most teachers, coaches, doctors, and therapists will tell you that parental involvement is a wonderful thing. But again, it's all about balance. Too little involvement is bad, and so is too much. By rushing in to dispute every subpar grade, force friendships between kids who don't actually get along, or do their work for them, helicopter parents were doing what seemed right for their kids in the short term without necessarily considering the long-term impact of their behavior. Jessica Leahy, talking about her own children in The Gift of Failure, admits, "I'd so successfully researched, planned, and constructed their comfortable childhoods that I'd failed to teach them how to adapt to the world on its terms." A former Stanford dean, Julie Lithcott-Hames, wrote a book called How to Raise an Adult, in which she discusses the growing phenomenon of parents on college campuses, virtually and literally. She's not the only one who tells stories about parents who continue to hover even after their children go off to university, a time that should be a transition to independent adult living. I heard one story of an undergrad who has a webcam set up in his dorm room so his parents can make sure he gets up in time for class in the morning. Lithcott-Hames offers an uncomfortable picture of college-age students who are so overly reliant on their parents that they struggle to handle things like paying their own bills, doing their own laundry, or making simple decisions on their own. All that overparenting has also made many of them desperately afraid of failure and uncertain how to handle conflict or setbacks. They seem to be scanning the sidelines for mom and dad, she writes, unable to cope with the normal ups and downs of life. And having not yet learned those skills, they graduate from college and enter the workforce. Lithcott-Hames offers a degree of credibility to so many employers' accusations that the millennials in their companies seem unprepared and lack initiative and resourcefulness. Her observations also explain why millennials feel that they lack decent mentorship at work or that their bosses don't give them enough direction. Two sides of the same coin. Where their parents helped them while growing up, a good deal of millennials now look to their bosses to do the same. Compare this to the experience Richard Branson had as a boy. In a Time magazine interview, Eve Branson, Richard's mother, tells the story of how she helped her then 7-year-old son overcome his severe shyness. When driving home from a nearby village one day, Eve pulled the car over 3 miles from their house and told Richard to get out. "You will now walk home," she said. "You will have to talk to people to find your way home." After 10 hours, Richard finally made it back. As Eve explained, the reason it took him so long was because she forgot to account for the fact that he would stop to examine all the bugs and rocks along the way. We all know the rest of the story. Branson went on to become one of the most successful and famous entrepreneurs in the world. Mary Mazzio, who interviewed Branson's mother for the Time article, also produced a documentary called Lemonade Stories, in which Eve and other mothers of successful entrepreneurs talk about their children's upbringings. The stories made an impression on Mazzio, herself a mother. "It occurs to me," she concludes, "that if American parents want to raise children who think entrepreneurially, have initiative, and become innovative and truly independent adults, it might serve us all well if we stepped back and let our sweet darlings make mistakes and fall on their faces from time to time." Though Mazzio's advice to parents could be transformative for our youngest generation, Gen Z, it's too little, too late for the overprotected millennials who are now in the workforce. In his 1969 book, The Psychology of Self-Esteem, Nathaniel Brandon theorized that the higher the level of a man's self-esteem, the higher the goals he sets for himself, and the more demanding the challenges he tends to seek. Boomer parents grabbed onto the idea that confidence was the key to their children's future success. And the self-esteem movement was born, emerging in full-blown form in the 1980s. For a good many millennials, excessive positive affirmation was now piled on top of excessive protection from failure and criticism. Unfortunately, despite their best intentions, many parents oversimplified things a bit. While Brandon and others pointed to the interdependence of self-esteem and traits like perseverance, self-responsibility, and the ability to problem-solve, most parents attempted to instill self-esteem in their children chiefly through verbal praise and extrinsic rewards. Many raised their kids by constantly telling them that they were unique and special, and that they could do anything they wanted and would, without doubt, do amazing things. Everyone was a winner. Come in first in the race, here's your trophy. Come in last, here's your trophy too. In fact, here's a trophy for everyone. Few can argue that self-confidence matters, and without question, positive affirmation helps build it. However, all good things in moderation. A glass of red wine per day is good for us. That doesn't mean that a bottle of red wine per day is better. In the same way, positively affirming kids' talents and encouraging their attempts is indeed good for them. But that doesn't mean that telling our kids they are great at everything is necessarily better. The use and overuse of extrinsic rewards follow the same logic. Giving out awards is good. Giving out awards to everyone who participates is not necessarily better. The thinking behind the participation awards, another hallmark of millennial childhood, is that it can boost confidence and keep students engaged in something that they might otherwise quit because, for example, they feel like they're not good at it. Unfortunately, the unintended consequences may outweigh the perceived benefits. Research shows that more extrinsic rewards do not add up to greater inner drive. In fact, they have the opposite effect, a decline in intrinsic motivation. Nor do extrinsic rewards motivate children or any of us in the long term. The most they provide is a short-term lift. If children see the reward as the only reason for doing something, studies show that once the reward is gone, they will have even less interest in the activity than they did when they started. This is the same reason why extrinsic dopamine-based reward systems, like hit the goal, get the bonus, when used as the primary means of incentivizing behavior in a work environment, can't and don't breed trust, loyalty, or commitment. Rewards for basic participation have other adverse effects as well. They not only deny children the chance to learn important lessons about adversity, loss, and resilience, but they can also encourage complacency and overconfidence. There is little incentive to do more or get better at something, the studies reveal, if all we have to do to get a trophy is show up. What we call entitlement could actually be a mismatch between the reality of what millennials experienced in their youth and what they later experience in the workplace. In the real world, we get nothing for coming in last. Sometimes we don't even get anything for coming in first. Even when they made mistakes while growing up, too many millennials were not forced to take personal responsibility for their behavior. One veteran teacher, who now teaches other teachers how to teach, told me a story about how a fight broke out in a new teacher's classroom. The new teacher broke up the fight, but he decided not to report the incident to the principal. The next day, a parent of one of the students involved in the fight came to the school and complained to administrators that the teacher's classroom was in chaos. Without the years of experience that may have at least helped shield a more senior teacher, the first-year teacher was fired. The incident continues to follow him in his career. The students, on the other hand, suffered little to no repercussions. Consistent with the patterns of you can do no wrong, it was the parents' instinct to blame the teacher and the school before holding the children accountable. Stories like these help us understand the circumstances in which many millennials were raised and why so many of them seem to their employers to have an insatiable appetite for appreciation. They also provide some context for why so many millennials in the workplace seem to struggle with criticism. A group raised to think they are special used to having their parents guide, support, and intervene at any sign of struggle or setback, and accustomed to regular praise and rewards, find few of those things in corporate culture. At work, they are not treated as special. Their parents can't get them a promotion. Their bosses do not shower them with praise and aren't always there to guide them or explain everything. In other words, work isn't giving them the very things upon which their self-esteem is built. Fully aware that their bosses aren't necessarily giving them what they need, many millennials are leaning on their connectedness to help cope or vent about their experiences. They text with friends, they take little breaks to see what others are up to on Instagram, or Snapchat while finding things they can share about what they are doing. However, their advanced technological skills may only be making things worse. The distracted generation. Imagine you're sitting on a plane, flying at 35,000 feet and 525 miles per hour from New York to Seattle. It's a calm flight. There's no turbulence. It's a clear day, and the captain predicts that the whole flight will be a smooth one. Both the captain and co-pilot are seasoned pilots with many, many years of experience, and the aircraft is equipped with the most modern avionics and warning systems. As required by the FAA, both pilots fly the airline simulator a few times a year to practice dealing with various emergencies. 100 miles away, in a dark room in a building with no windows, sits an air traffic controller with 10 years' experience looking down a scope, monitoring all the air traffic in his assigned sector. Your flight is currently on his scope. Now imagine that the controller has his cell phone next to him. He's not allowed to make calls while he's on duty, but he can send and receive texts or access his email. Imagine that he's relaying coordinates to your flight, checking his messages, relaying coordinates to another flight, checking his phone again. Seems fair, right? As plain as the nose on my face, I am confident that the vast majority of us would not be very comfortable with this scenario. We would prefer that the air traffic controller check his email or send his text messages during his breaks. I think we would feel much better if access to the internet and personal cell phone were completely forbidden when an air traffic controller is on duty, which they are. Only because our lives are at stake do we see this example as stark. So if we take the life and death part away, why would we think that we can do our work, check our phones, write a paragraph, send a text, write another paragraph, send another text, without the same damage to our ability to concentrate? Many millennials think that because they grew up with all these technologies, they're better at multitasking, and they often use multiple devices at the same time. In the Frontline episode, Digital Nation, college students talk about multitasking in both social life and the classroom. You're talking to your friend at the same time you're talking to your other friend, same time you're emailing another friend about what you're going to do tomorrow night, one student says. School is just kind of the same. Like you're paying attention in class to your professor, you're emailing another professor, and you're looking up something else. Many millennials consider this behavior a way of increasing their productivity and expect others should find it acceptable. Another student featured in the Frontline report says, "I feel like the professors here do have to accept that we can multitask very well. Despite the millennial insistence that they are high-functioning multitaskers, and a general acceptance among many non-millennials that this may in fact be the case, the science suggests otherwise. According to brain researchers, true multitasking does not actually exist. Rather, what we are doing is mental juggling, or rapid toggling between tasks. In other words, we aren't doing two things at once. We are merely switching back and forth between things. This is an important distinction. Despite what multitaskers might think, transitioning between tasks does not happen quickly or smoothly, particularly if complex tasks are involved. It takes time for our brains to reset and return, reset and return. Multitasking, it turns out, does not make us faster or more efficient. It actually slows us down. According to the American Psychological Association, shifting between tasks can cost as much as 40% of someone's productive time. In studies of workplace behavior, University of California Irvine researchers found similar results. When a worker is interrupted, it takes them around 23 minutes to return to their original task. Now consider that the average worker is interrupted about every 3 minutes. The more external interruptions we experience, like a text or an email alert, the more we engage in self-interruption. That is, interrupting ourselves mid-task to check our email or phones without any notification from a ring or a bing. In other words, interruptions lead to more interruptions. And more interruptions not only reduce opportunities for focused, deep thought, but they also delay the completion of work and increase feelings of pressure and stress, which leads to even greater stress and more pressure. You get the point. The problem with switching between tasks isn't just about productivity. In a Stanford University study of college students, self-proclaimed chronic multitaskers made more mistakes and remembered less than those who considered themselves infrequent multitaskers. Another Stanford study found evidence to suggest that chronic multitaskers were worse at analytical reasoning as well. MIT professor David Jones has noticed similar patterns in his classes. His students, on the whole, are not doing as well as they should be. It's not that the students are dumb, he says. It's not that they're not trying. I think they're trying in a way that's not as effective as it could be because they're distracted by everything else. The evidence is indisputable. Despite what they or anyone else believes, with rare exceptions, those who think they are more productive because they are better at multitasking are just wrong. What they are better at is being distracted. The number of children and young people diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, shot up 66% between 2000 and 2010 and continued to rise between 2011 and 2014. Why the sudden huge spike in a frontal lobe dysfunction over the course of a decade? The Centers for Disease Control define those with ADHD as having trouble paying attention, controlling impulsive behaviors, may act without thinking about what the result will be, or being overly active. I would submit that this huge spike is not simply because more people have ADHD than previous generations, though that could be true, nor is it due to an increase in the number of parents having their children tested, though this could also be true. Though there are, of course, many genuine cases of ADHD, the sudden spike may be the result of something as simple as misdiagnosis. What I believe is likely happening is that more young people are developing an addiction to distraction, or rather, to the dopamine-producing effects of the digital technologies and online activities that are distracting them. Just like people who are addicted to drinking, smoking, and gambling, we can find our cravings for texts, likes, or email notifications difficult to resist. When our phones ding while we're driving, we must look immediately to see who just sent us a text, even though we all know it's dangerous to do so. When we're trying to get some work done and our phones vibrate across the desk, we break concentration and have to look now, even though we know we have a deadline. If email is down, or if we leave our phone at home, many of us actually start to get anxious. It's not just that our behavior seems to look like that of addicts. It may be that we actually are addicts. The biology is the same. The dopamine hit we get from the bing, buzz, flash, or beep of our phones feels good. We like how it feels when we get a notification that someone commented on one of our posts on Facebook or Instagram. Or, if we're feeling a little bit down or lonely, some of us will send out a quick text to a whole bunch of friends, hoping that at least one of them will write back immediately. Because if they do, that little burst of dopamine makes us feel better. But once it wears off, we go back to how we felt, and we crave another hit. This is particularly dangerous when it comes to the teenage brain. We have strict age restrictions for alcohol, cigarettes, and gambling, because we know that the still-forming brains and neural pathways of teenagers make them especially susceptible to addiction. More than 40% of children who discover alcohol before age 15 will become alcoholics later in life. And the same percentage of adult alcoholics report that they drank regularly between the ages of 15 and 19. Brain researchers know that teenagers require more dopamine than adults to reach the same level of stimulation, which means that teenagers need to indulge more than adults to experience the same effects. But because we do not formally recognize digital addiction in the United States, we have done little to restrict young people's access to dopamine-producing digital activity. Parents, even though they express serious misgivings about how much time their kids spend in front of their screens, don't seem to be doing much to keep devices out of their kids' hands. According to the Pew Research Center, as of 2015, 88% of teenagers aged 13 to 17 had access to cell phones or smartphones, a number that is more than double than it was in 2013. And our laws don't seem to be filling the gaps. In both China and South Korea, internet addiction is recognized, and in South Korea, it's treated as a psychiatric disorder. The Korean government has responded by opening up free internet rescue camps for kids. At the camps, kids experience the equivalent of detox. Their devices are taken away, and they receive counseling. Korean schools are also working proactively against digital addiction. Starting in second grade, students are required to learn about responsible computer use and healthy digital habits. We have no such government help in America. Though the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998, COPPA, unintentionally shields kids under 13 from addictive online activities, its specific intent was, as its name suggests, to protect their privacy by prohibiting websites and apps from collecting data on them. Though many social media sites refuse to allow those under age 13 to sign up for accounts, they do so in large part to avoid the costs and complications of compliance with COPPA. A few services, like YouTube, require someone to be at least 18 to have an account. But these restrictions are usually set up to guard young people from inappropriate material and can often be waived with a parent's permission or a simple click of a button acknowledging the user is of age. The bottom line is that 13 to 18-year-olds are left almost completely vulnerable to the addictive qualities of dopamine-releasing activities online and on their devices at the very moment they are most susceptible to them. Of course, not all kids who use smartphones or engage in social media will form addictions, but the risk is real and significant. And even if they don't form addictions, their developing brains will, without question, be affected. How a young person chooses to spend their time will have a profound effect on what their brain will be like for the rest of their lives, says a leading neuroscientist from the Semmel Institute at UCLA. In the best-case scenario, young people's brains will change such that the benefits of social media, smartphones, and other devices outweigh the negatives. In the worst case, we will have a generation in which a disproportionately high number of people lack the coping skills necessary to deal with stress as adults. Sadly, the evidence already seems to be tilting toward the latter. When we're very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. As we go through adolescence, we make a transition to needing the approval of our peers. A highly stressful and anxious period in our lives, this transition is supposed to teach us to rely on our friends to cope with the stress. Though it may be frustrating for our parents when we start to care more about what our friends think than what they think, it is very important for us. It allows us to build the skills we need to make friends and form trusting relationships beyond our immediate families so that we may become valuable and trusted members of the broader tribe. Some teenagers, quite by accident, discover that alcohol can help them cope with their teenage angst. We know that sometimes our wires can get crossed and the wrong behaviors can be incentivized. Someone who finds the dopamine and serotonin-releasing effects of alcohol as a teenager can become conditioned to look to alcohol to suppress emotional pain instead of adopting other, healthier coping mechanisms. For some, that connection becomes hardwired in their brains, and for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person for help. They will turn to the bottle. Again, the biology and the mechanics of addiction are exactly the same for most other dopamine-producing things like gambling, smoking, texting, and engaging with social media. When our children are conditioned to look for a digital hit when they are stressed, for the rest of their lives, When they suffer social stress, financial stress, or career stress, they will turn not to a person for support, but to a device. I want an Oompa Loompa now. This is a high-speed world. Gone are the days when we checked stock prices in the morning newspaper. Now everyone can study their investments in real time. Companies track their success in months and quarters, not years. Why should we wait when we can have what we want when we want it? You want to buy something? You go on Amazon. It arrives the next day. You want to watch a movie? You don't have to check movie times. Just log on and stream it now. You want to watch a TV show? You don't have to wait week to week to week for the next episode. Binge! Even our social lives can be satisfied instantly. You want to go on a date? Just swipe right. No more awkward conversations with strangers required. For millennials who came of age in this world of instant gratification, seeing what you want and getting it when you want it is normal. For many, it's a baseline expectation. And that's all fine and good if we're talking about shopping and movies. However, when it comes to finding a feeling of fulfillment in one's life or career, things get a little more complicated. As a generation, millennials tend to be socially conscious. They care about the world around them, and they want to make an impact, both personally and professionally. According to the 2015 annual Deloitte Millennial Survey, 90% of millennials globally want to use their skills for good, and 6 in 10 report a sense of purpose as the reason they chose to work for their current employer. I love this about millennials. I wish more of us cared as much as they do. The issue isn't the goal. It's the expectations they have about the time it takes to achieve that goal. While doing research for this book, I kept meeting amazing, wonderful, smart, driven, and optimistic millennials who quickly became disillusioned with their entry or junior level positions because they didn't feel like they were making a real difference. After only a few months in their jobs, many were considering quitting. Rather than questioning their expectations or giving things some time, they assumed the job was the problem. At a different company, perhaps at one they started themselves, they reasoned things would be better. Impact and fulfillment would be there on day one, or at least after a few weeks. Millennials aren't just looking for work to provide them with the fulfillment that comes from doing good in the world. Many of them donate and volunteer. More, in fact, than you might suspect. Although the data shows that millennials' charitable activities become more focused and longer-lasting as they get older, most younger millennials seem to take a scattered, almost random approach. Because of their impulse for instant gratification, the slow plod of service has been replaced with a quick burst of drive-by philanthropy. Giving, it seems, has become another area in which millennials try to multitask. Bouncing from one cause to another, giving a little here and a little there, they feel like they can make a difference in lots of places, sometimes all at once. Just as the internet, social media, and their cell phones help them multitask in their social and academic lives, so too are they deployed in the name of service. Now we can text a donation, forward an email, post a video, wear a colored wristband, add a filter to our avatar, like a cause we care about, show solidarity on Instagram, hashtag our opinion, shop from a socially conscious brand, and sign an online petition, all while heading to brunch in an Uber, unless we're boycotting them this month to express our political views, hashtag boycott. In an instant, the desire to do real good in the world starts to look like a lot of disconnected symbolic gestures that don't add up to much for the giver or the cause. In 2014, the ALS Association encouraged people to take the Ice Bucket Challenge, a social media-driven campaign to raise awareness and hopefully money for the charity. The idea was that you would have a bucket of ice water dumped on your head, and you would post a video of it on social media, then nominate friends to do the same. Like any fad or viral video, no one could have predicted how popular it was going to be. More than 17 million people, including an exceptionally high number of millennials, participated. The ALS Association brought attention to the cause and raised $115 million more that year, a nearly 500% increase in the amount they raised the previous year. Yet that money came from just 2.5 million people. In other words, the overwhelming majority of people who participated did not make donations. And perhaps that doesn't matter. The success of the effort, or how to create a successful online campaign, is not the discussion. How an addiction to devices and virtual approval affects our behavior and the feelings we have about ourselves is. The cynic in me doubts that most who participated in the Ice Bucket Challenge have a deep sense of commitment to help eradicate Lou Gehrig's disease in the world, or even how many people who participated knew that Lou Gehrig's disease and ALS are the same thing, or what the disease does to the human body. It's safe to say that the overwhelming majority who took part in the Ice Bucket Challenge probably didn't participate to be a part of a cause that deeply mattered to them. We participated in the campaign because it was fun and it felt good to be a part of a media sensation, or we were uncomfortable with the thought that we would be the one of our friends who didn't do it. Remember, this is the generation that gave us FOMO, fear of missing out. It's hard to fault anyone who participated in the challenge given the results. And we must assume that most of them participated with the best of intentions. However, let's just call a spade. This kind of activism does not contribute to the longer-term financial prospects of an organization, nor does it generate ongoing relationships between the organization and the participants. Though the ALS Association ran the Ice Bucket Challenge again the following year, the total revenues were almost exactly the same as they were the year before the original campaign. In other words, it worked once. Then everything went back, for the most part, to the way it used to be. I'm not suggesting we should stop doing these kinds of things. We absolutely should. But we do need to recognize that they are not the way to achieve systemic change in the world or a lasting sense of fulfillment in ourselves. These things, as I've said before, require a single-minded, ongoing commitment of time and energy. From the 1848 gathering at Seneca Falls, which is seen as the official launch of the women's suffrage movement in the United States, to the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920, it took 72 years for women to win the right to vote. The majority of the founders and leaders of the movement, women like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucretia Mott, died before, some long before, a single woman ever exercised that right. However, even if they never lived to see their dream come alive, I can almost guarantee that those leaders of the movement felt quite fulfilled at the end of their lives because of the cause they helped to advance for theirs and future generations, a cause that didn't end when the first woman voted, but will continue as long as women are denied equal rights in other areas of life too. This is what it means to be a part of something bigger than ourselves, that we are a part of a movement that will live on beyond the goals we set or the lives of the people who set them. It's the camaraderie and the shared purpose, as much as the milestones we set, that give our lives meaning. It is only by committing to a path, remaining steadfast on that journey, sticking it out through thick and thin, and marching shoulder to shoulder with those who share our values and our vision, that we can ever find that deep sense of joy, satisfaction, and fulfillment in our lives. This is as true for our careers as it is for social movements. It's as if many millennials are standing at the foot of a mountain, and they can see what they want to make an impact or find fulfillment. They can see the summit. What many can't seem to see is the mountain. This has nothing to do with an older generation insisting that the younger generation do their time. Though we may all advance up the mountain at different paces, some of us faster and some of us slower, there's still no avoiding the mountain. When millennials stand at the foot of the mountain, looking up at the thing they want to achieve, they, like all of us, must remember that the summit serves only to set the direction in which we will march. Opportunities to lead and feelings of safety and belonging do not suddenly appear when we reach the mountain peak. These are the things we find and develop on the journey up, the sometimes long, sometimes arduous journey. And as if I haven't beaten this analogy to death enough, there's no cell service on the mountain, so get used to appreciating the little and the big wins without posting any selfies anywhere. I will concede that impatience is perhaps only part of the reason so many millennials quit their jobs so quickly. The other part is that too many companies don't have a clear sense of purpose, cause, or belief to offer them. Too many company mission and vision statements talk about being the best, the biggest, or the most respected, all goals that are self-centered and offer zero contribution to the world. How are millennials ever to live their why if the companies that court them don't have a sense of why themselves? If you want to ignore or discount everything I have said to this point, if you think I'm completely off base with my discussion about parenting styles, if you think multitasking is real and that we suffer no imbalance in our lives whatsoever, if you think millennials are absolutely right to quit as soon as they suspect this place isn't for me, if you're an employer who wants to blame everything on millennials themselves, or a millennial who thinks your boss doesn't get it, I beg you to at least take this last piece to heart. The dire scenario. You may have noticed a recurring theme throughout this book and this chapter: the importance of relationships, not only to our survival, but also to our sense of fulfillment. This is no less true for human beings working in the modern workplace than it was for human beings living in tribes 50,000 years ago. I find it frightening that millennials have grown up, and that the youngest generation is now growing up, in a world that seems dead set on denying them the opportunity to build such deep, meaningful relationships. Addiction in any form undermines relationships. The desire for instant gratification allows no time for relationships to develop. Digital communication can stand in the way of deepening our relationships, and social media can deny us the chance to create real relationships to begin with. Perhaps even worse, it can be devastating to our own sense of self-worth. While it is hard for many of us, regardless of age, to build relationships of value, research suggests that the millennial generation may be struggling more than most. Teenagers are socializing less in real life while engaging in social media more. The pattern continues into college, where there is less chance that they will form tangible relationships with their peers. The number of millennials of all ages who engage with social media and the amount of time they spend with it is astounding. A nationwide study by the Pew Research Center finds that social media usage among 18 to 29-year-olds has increased by almost 1,000% in less than a decade. By some estimates, more than 98% of college students participate in social networking online. And a 2014 survey done by UCLA showed that 27% of undergrads are on social media more than 6 hours a week. Meanwhile, a 2015 survey by Common Sense Media shows that 60% of teens, 13 to 18-year-olds, are on social media daily, on average, more than an hour. Of course, social media is amazing in many ways. It allows us to stay in touch with friends and family across the globe. And I cannot dispute that for some young people, especially the very shy, engaging in social media can help them feel like they have some sort of connection to a group. Some teens say that social media acts as a gateway to real-life friendships. Others say that social media gives them a place where they feel freer to be their true selves. A full 1 in 3 teens say they feel more accepted online than in the real world. But such relationships rarely go beyond the superficial. There is no getting away from the truth. There is simply nothing that can replace real, face-to-face, human interaction. Perhaps this is the reason one millennial I spoke with admitted that he struggles to form deep, meaningful friendships. Not only are virtual relationships a poor substitute for real ones, but social media can actually make us feel lonelier. As one student at Franklin and Marshall College put it, social media is a really easy way to feel excluded. Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat make me hyper-aware of the activities I wasn't invited to partake in and less involved in the activities that are actually in front of me. And feeling left out is just the beginning. Studies have shown that people who spend excessive time on social media experience higher rates of depression and anxiety. A 2013 study by social scientists at the University of Michigan, for instance, tracked the use of Facebook by 82 young adults over a two-week period. At the end of the period, the subjects who had spent the most time overall on the network reported less satisfaction with their lives. Rather than enhancing well-being, Facebook may undermine it, the study concluded. When we are immersed in a Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat world, where everyone's lives are on display, it's hard not to compare ourselves to others, and it's easy to become envious and doubt the quality of our own lives when our friends' posts come off like a highlight reel of the year's best movies. True or not, exaggerated or not, filtered or not, what they see on social media makes many of the millennials I've spoken with feel like they're in competition with their peers. One millennial, who is currently out of work, told me that she jumps at opportunities to engage in networking or social events just so that she can have something to post online that makes her appear to be keeping up. In an unfortunate twist, the drive for real individual accomplishments seems to have turned into a game of virtual one-upmanship based on the illusion of perfection. Millennials have become well-practiced at curating their lives. They know better than anyone how to manage their personal brands and present themselves as they want to be seen, not necessarily as they are. They may look confident. They may sound like they have all the answers and know exactly how to navigate their lives in the world. However, behind the filter, many are plagued by more self-doubt and uncertainty than they let on. Though there is no hard evidence of a direct causal relationship, the correlation between increased use of social media among millennials and rising rates of depression and anxiety is hard to ignore. Universities today are experiencing what some are calling an epidemic of depression among students. And as many as 1 in 6 college students have been diagnosed with or treated for anxiety. For teens, the situation is even more concerning. The National Institute of Mental Health reports that in 2015, the number of young people between the ages of 12 and 17 who experienced a major depressive episode increased nearly 50% from what it was in 2005. In fact, teenagers now suffer depression at a rate twice that of adults. This is especially disconcerting, given that depression, along with social isolation, is a major indicator of suicide risk. Suicide is already the second leading cause of death among people 15 to 24, and that does not account for the number of young people who attempt suicide, which by some counts is as high as 25 to 1. Even more disturbing is the trend among kids 10 to 14. In the period between 1999 and 2014, the percent increase in the suicide rates for girls in this age range tripled. It was the single biggest increase by far in any age group, male or female. Boys 10 to 14 fared better, but still had the second biggest increase amongst men. The fact that teenage girls use social media almost twice as much as teenage boys, an hour and 32 minutes versus 52 minutes per day, and have a rate of depression nearly 5 times that of their male counterparts, does not bode well for this trend reversing itself anytime soon. As if the increasing rates of suicide among young people aren't bad enough, over the past several decades, we have also witnessed the rise of the truly terrifying phenomenon of school shootings. In the period from 1969 to 1978, 16 school shootings occurred in the United States. That number rose to 63 between 1999 and 2008. The next decade, though not even over at the writing of this book, has already surpassed these numbers. Between 2013 and 2017 alone, there have been more than 200 school shootings. Studies treat the data in various ways. Some define school shootings as incidents in which shots were fired. Others are limited to multi-victim events. But all the data show a clear and consistent increase that does not appear to be subsiding. What's more, many of the perpetrators are themselves students. A major FBI review of active shooting incidences from 2000 to 2013 indicates that all but 3 of 20 middle and high school events were carried out by students aged 12 to 19. It is difficult to ascribe school shootings to a single cause. Nonetheless, one persistent observation in studies is the number of adolescent shooters who hold low social status within their peer groups and struggle for recognition. Many are victims of bullying, teasing, or social exclusion. They perceive themselves as outcasts who are marginalized within communities to which they want to belong. Depression, substance abuse, or psychological disorders can, in turn, exacerbate their feelings of loneliness and rejection. Sick gazelles are pushed to the edge of the herd, pushed out of the circle of safety, so the lions might eat the weaker ones instead of the stronger ones. Our primitive mammal brains lead us to the same conclusion. When we feel like we're outside the circle of safety, with no sense of belonging, and no sense that others love and care for us, we feel out of control, abandoned, and left for dead. And when we feel that isolated, we become desperate. I do not believe there are digital solutions to the very real issues that millennials and the generation to follow face. There's no app to fix addiction, depression, suicide, or other antisocial behavior. These are human problems that require human solutions. I offer some ideas for parents, millennials, and leaders of companies at the end of this audiobook that may help us take steps to reverse the trends. The kids who are still growing up require parents and caregivers who help them develop self-esteem with intrinsic motivation at its foundation. Teach them problem-solving and non-digital coping strategies, and take more control over access to smartphones and social media. The millennials who are entering or are already in the workforce require employers who are empathetic, understand the challenges that this generation faces, create circles of safety, and find ways to make the most of the many positive attributes and unique skills that millennials bring to the table. And for millennials themselves, it means taking personal accountability, being willing to turn off their phones or disconnect from social media from time to time to engage in the kind of face-to-face human interaction that leads to real connection and meaningful relationships. Only then will they find the fulfillment they are looking for. We must stop blaming each other and start helping each other. It would seem that in the dire scenario, we are our own best hope.